to do, why not leave? Leaving solves everything. And she won't have to pay Kath a dime. That's how stupid Kath is. She doesn't realize that with blackmail, it's one or the other. You can't tell someone to leave and expect to be paid off. Why would Polly, once gone, care what anyone in Belleville thinks of her? Adam. It grieves her to leave him behind. Vulnerable to Kath's lies, if not to Kath herself. He will think the worst of Polly. That she's a killer, a liar, a rip-off artist, and maybe she deserves his low opinion. But only if he knows the whole story. Not whatever jumbled mess that Kath relates. If she leaves now, Kath wins. Kath can't win. Footsteps on the stairs. She watches the knob turn. Even the knob, squeaking in alarm, seems surprised when the door fails to open. Now it rattles, turning back and forth, as Adam whispers her name. Polly, Polly, it's me. Of course it's you. Who else would be at my door this late? She says nothing, just stares at the knob, mesmerized. Polly? Louder now. She stands still, barely breathing. He knows she's here. Where else would she be? How much do you want me? She thinks. It's not vanity on her part. It's vital information. She hears him retreating down the stairs. Okay, that's it. She has to leave town. He's not going to stand by her. She is already mentally packing. She'll rent a U-Haul, load up her things. She could be in Reno next week. Then, his footsteps roar back. It's like a big wave rolling in after a series of small ones have lulled you into thinking the surf is calm. To her shock and delight, the door flies open with what sounds like one swift kick, the frame splintering. He rushes in, and she's terrified, but only for a moment. This man will never hurt her. She jumps up, her arms circling his neck, confident of being caught.
What was that? He asks later.
What?
That stupid game with the door. Did you not tell me to come by tonight?
We have trouble, she says, and very little time to decide what to do. Kath's figured out that we're together. She's willing to do anything, anything, to force me to leave town. A woman scorned and all that. He won't believe the lies she's willing to spread. He doesn't ask about the lies. Interesting.
I'll go with you,
he says without hesitation. More interesting still. How much does he know? And how? Yet, he's loyal to her. Still wants her. Let's sleep on it, she says. I don't trust decisions made in the middle of the night. She is telling the truth. Although she killed Dittmars in the middle of the night, she planned it by day. For weeks and weeks, she planned. She was planning his murder even before she realized it. The universe all but told her to do it. It began with a nurse's aide, who came to help twice a week. Respite care, they called it. At first, Polly would use those hours to grocery shop. Then she found the film series at the museum, free on Thursday afternoons. And she escaped the long Baltimore summer in that cool, hushed place. Afterward, she'd go to the sculpture garden, studying the families in the museum restaurant, wondering what it would take to be like them. She couldn't believe that they were the same species on the same planet. That's how far away their lives seemed to her. The summer of 1985, the film series was all black and white films from the 1940s, Double Indemnity, Mildred Pierce, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Polly didn't understand at first how they were linked, why the series was called Raising Cain, but then someone explained they were all based on books by a Maryland man who had lived in Baltimore and Annapolis, grown up on the Eastern Shore. When fall came and the film series ended, she began going to the library and looked for the books that had inspired the movies. Be bold, Walter Huff told Phyllis Nerdlinger. No wonder they had changed the name for the movie.
Not even Barbara Stanwyck could play someone named Nerdlinger and make her sexy. Polly began to study the encyclopedias, the ones that didn't circulate. There was a diagram of the human body layered on three color transparencies that showed exactly where everything was. The heart is not really on the left side of the body, although we place our hands there to say the pledge. It's much closer to the center, and it tips slightly, almost as if it were drunk. Once you know where the heart is, then you need to know where the rib cage is, because even the best knife could break on a bone. Night after night, Polly slipped her arms around Dittmar's, tickling his chest softly, counting his ribs, willing her fingers to memorize the topography of his body. She needed the best knife she could find, so she squirreled away money, bought a beauty of a Japanese butcher knife, one she never used for carving. She would get one chance, only one. She went to sleep night after night next to her husband, praying for the literal strength to kill him. Sleep? Adam asks. Eventually, she says, putting her hand in his. They lie on their backs, side by side, like brother and sister. When she tells him everything, he will understand, right? Right? Polly is up with the sun. Adam finds her at the kitchen table, not a stitch on, drinking hot coffee. No matter how warm the day, she always wants to start it with a cup of hot coffee. So we go, right? He says. There's nothing to bind us here. Casper will have a heart attack if you leave. He'll do anything for you. Summer's almost over. Doesn't matter how good the food is. No one's going to come to Belleville just for the food. They might, if the place were nice enough. A little paint, cosmetic changes. It could be something really special. I don't see that happening. Maybe not right away, but it's more your place now than his. He'd probably do whatever it takes to keep you. I don't see why we should have to go. But if you don't want Kath to tell people about you, maybe she should go. She's pretty rooted, best I can tell. They say the big trees topple over fastest, because they don't bend. What are you saying? The only power she has over me is what she knows. I'm going to tell you what she's got on me, Adam. What she thinks she's got on me. You don't have to do that. No, I do. I need you to decide if you want to be with me once everything is out in the open. He takes the mug of coffee out of her hand, says, Baby, I do know. What, exactly? I know who you used to be. What you did. How? A pause. She already told me. And? Years go by. Dinosaurs roam the earth, find extinction, mankind begins, Jesus dies on the cross. Columbus sails to America. The world wars are fought. All those things happen while she waits for him to reply. I don't care. He loves her. He actually loves her. Then I'll tell her tonight that she can say whatever she thinks she knows. I'm not leaving. And today I'll tell Casper. I don't want him to hear it from her. You said she wanted money from you. Can't get blood from a stone? He falls to his knees in front of her, almost as if he were about to propose, which delights and terrifies her in equal measure. But all Adam wants to do is bury his head in her midsection like a child. They remain this way for a very long time, Polly cradling Adam's head, grateful the world has finally sent her the man she needs, the man she deserves.
Chapter 20.
Adam clocks Kath making a beeline for him the first chance she gets at work. It's Thursday, the last day of August. They're busy at lunch and dinner. Mr. C can get by with Kath alone on the lunch shift, but he'll need both his waitresses for dinner.
Your girlfriend's not who you think she is,
she says. He says, what girlfriend? And keeps on working. He's layering mozzarella between local tomatoes, then drizzling pesto vinaigrette. It doesn't really require a lot of focus, but he keeps his eyes on those tomatoes as if he's making rosettes for a wedding cake. Kath, perhaps mindful of the fact that it's hard to collect blackmail once you've let the secrets out into the air, doesn't say anything more, just cocks her hip, then saunters away, swinging her ass hard. He's dying to learn how much she knows. The facts in the video are the ones in the public domain, and her state trooper brother-in-law might have been able to grab some records, especially if Kath filched Polly's social security number. But the money that Irving knows about, nobody knows about that, according to Irving. He only found out by accident. Millions, he said, and one on a lie. According to Irving, who didn't bother to tell Adam about Polly's past until he decided he wanted to make Adam feel like a jerk. It's funny, knowing what he knows now isn't enough to make him stop loving her. But if he had known all along, it might have been enough to stop him from falling in the first place. Barn door open, horse gone. Adam has never had these out-of-control feelings about a woman before, not even the woman he loved enough, for a time, to marry, Lainey. She never even crosses his mind. Polly never leaves it. He keeps thinking this has to end, that it's like a flu or fever that will run its course. He had moments where he believed he could walk away from her, collect his last check from Irving, and enjoy the fall on another continent. And then he kicked her door in. She tried to act tough, but he wasn't fooled. She was terrified when he came through that door. Memories of her ex, he's guessing. But she also seemed excited. It's a complicated thing, the human brain. No one wants to be abused. But what if, after the fights, some chemical is released? What if the fight is a kind of drug that leads to a high? What do you do then? They should leave together. And then what? Irving could destroy his reputation pretty fast if Adam takes up with Polly. No one's going to want to hire the PI who fell in love with his target. Polly told him last night that she doesn't want to settle more than 100 miles from Baltimore, maybe 200, although she refused to say why. He thinks about the trip back to the city, the day he followed her. The answer is on Rogers Avenue, or nearby. Could the money be there? Has she entrusted the cash to a third party she believes won't rip her off? She has no family left in Maryland, according to Irving, and she isn't a woman who makes friends easily. The film mentioned a disabled daughter. So maybe that's the stepdaughter she ripped off? If she ripped her off. Philadelphia, Richmond, Pittsburgh, New York. Her 200-mile radius leaves them with a nice array of options. He can't see himself in New York. Money doesn't go far there. He doesn't want to live in the South. He knows Maryland is technically the South, but the D.C. Baltimore area has been an okay base. Richmond is South-South. Pittsburgh, though, it's a city. But it's easy to get to nature from there. Maybe not the ocean, but he could still hunt in western Maryland. And you can be in Canada in less than 4 hours. Canada? Where did that come from? He pauses, knife in hand, tries to nail down his own chain of thought. Escape, running away. They're gonna run away from here. Once you start to run, you never stop. Maybe she's right. They should hold their ground. Face down, Kath. Make her ashamed to think she could use Polly's past against her. Make her the bad guy. But they would still have to contend with Irving. Adam has to persuade Irving there is no money. That it was all a bullshit story. To do that, he would have to talk to her about what he's been told, get her side of things. He would have to tell her that it was no accident, him finding her here. Would she forgive him? Would she ever trust him again? If she knew he'd been hired to befriend her, follow her, find this money that may or may not exist? They need to go. He'll persuade her tomorrow. That's the only safe way. Chapter 21. If there is one thing Polly knows how to do, it's waiting. It's her talent, her art. Waitress, indeed. She's a pro. Her life began with waiting. But isn't that what all teenage girls do? You put on a yellow bathing suit and you wait for your life to begin. There was Burton Ditmars, tanned and muscled and so grown up. She was 14. She cannot blame herself for thinking he was offering her a life. The next phase was waiting for Ditmars to come home. Then she began waiting even more eagerly for him to go out. The night Joy was born, she waited for the doctor to come, screaming at nurses that it was time, it was time, it was time. She waited through doctor's appointments, waited for Ditmars to hit her because then she would be in that briefly benevolent after phase, all sweetness and gifts and back rubs. Strangely, when she discovered that non-profit that organized timeouts for women such as herself, she initially found herself watching the clock during her liberty, longing for it to end. She didn't know what to do with 4 hours to herself. Shop? She had no money of her own. And it made her jumpy, trying to relax in her own house with another person in it. Plus, Joy knew she was there. Polly had to leave in order to enjoy her respite, and that was no respite at all. The longest wait of all had been in the weeks before she killed Ditmars. She was not trying to concoct the perfect murder, per Walter Huff's advice to Phyllis in Double Indemnity. She was resigned to not getting away with it, although she did her best. Lord knows there was no shortage of people who had reason to want Ditmars dead, given the things he had done. Her fear was that she would only maim Ditmars, deal him a crippling injury, and then she would be trapped with him forever, caring for him. Prison had been easy for a waiting pro such as herself. Unpleasant, cruel, but easy. The affronts predictable and impersonal. Unlike life with Ditmars, it could be managed once she learned the rules and personalities. She assumed she would never get out, so all she was waiting for was one day to end and another to begin. Then she was released, met Greg, fucked him up by fucking him, and that was that. She might as well have gone back to prison. Luck, so overdue, finally arrived in the form of a nasal Baltimore voice, shouting at her from the television during an All My Children commercial break. She knew that voice, that guy, that shyster. Irving used to complain about him all the time. But anyone who did business with Irving had to be a little bent. Look at Ditmars. She called the number that promised to change her life. And for once, a man's promise was kept. Then, a new wait. She is still waiting. But it's a waiting she has chosen, so she has power. It's her decision to wait a little longer. What will she tell Adam 6, 8 months from now? She'll figure something out. It's easy to make people believe in good luck. Because who doesn't want to believe in good luck? At work that night, Polly lets Kath's deadline approach, showing no concern. She has no concerns. She tells Mr. C what's what, and sure enough, he doesn't care.
He hit you, this man?
Polly nods. Hit doesn't begin to cover what Dittmars did to her, but it's good enough.
You did your time. You deserve to be out. It's nobody's business, he says. If my business falls off and I can keep only one waitress, it'll be you. You're the better one. And you make my cook happy.
So Mr. C knows about them, too. She and Adam must have been terrible at hiding their relationship. Mr. C is the most oblivious man she's ever met. Not a bad thing in a man. Her preference, actually. It's a busy night. The last Thursday in August. And Polly makes sure she is on top of her game, putting a little extra into her encounters with Max and Ernest, laughing at their stale jokes and observations. She can tell it throws Kath off her stride, seeing Polly happy and calm. Toward 10 p.m., Kath corners Polly by the ice machine.
What about that thing we talked about?
Polly waits a beat, as if puzzled, as if it's so inconsequential as to have slipped her mind.
Oh, that. Do you have my money?
No.
Tonight is the deadline.
Polly shrugs. What can I do? You didn't give me very much notice.
I'm gonna tell everyone.
Fine.
Not just Adam. Everybody.
Okay.
You'll have to leave. This is a small town. People won't want to come here once they know. Casper won't be able to keep you on.
She shrugs. I'll let him be the one to tell me that, if that's okay with you. Her coolness infuriates Kath. She's the nervous one now, worried that her bombshell is all fizzle, no pop. She has to make good on her threat, or she'll look like a fool. She is a fool. She has blackmailed Polly into doing the best thing. No more secrets from anyone. Well, almost no secrets, just the one. And it's a happy one. Happy secrets are okay. That night, Polly doesn't slip Adam the usual Adam and Eve note signaling that she hopes for a visit from him. He's puzzled, she can tell, but she needs to be alone and sit in the quiet of this new life. She walks home, finds herself humming. She likes it here, in Belleville. She's happy to stay, maybe not forever, but for a good long while. She's having a glass of wine at her metal-top table when she hears a slight tap. She smiles. Adam jury-rigged the door this morning, but it doesn't really lock. She's had her alone time, and now she's glad he presumed he could drop by.
Come in, she calls out. It's not like I could lock it now if I tried.
Only, it's Kath.
If you're gonna stay, you better give me some money,
she says, without preamble. Her words a slurry rush. There's booze on her breath. I am staying, Polly says, and Casper says if he has to let one of us go, it's going to be you.
I don't believe that.
Ask him.
Then you damn well better give me some money.
I don't have any money.
That's not what I heard.
I can't be responsible for what you've heard. I don't have any money. A pause. Although I guess I'll have a lot more when I'm the only one waiting tables at the Hi-Ho.
What about your husband?
My husband's dead, as you know. I killed him. And I don't care who knows anymore. My sentence was commuted. I was defending my own life, in a sense.
Not him. The one who came looking for you. I bet he'd pay something for what I know.
Polly laughs at this. She's not sure what's funnier, the idea of Greg having money, or Greg giving it up. Does Kath think there's going to be a custody battle over Janny?
Go ask him. Heck, take him. He's available.
Make sure you use a condom, though. His sperm is pretty determined.
I bet you got knocked up on purpose.
Polly sees herself in the bathroom in her apartment 4 years ago, staring with dismay at a beaming pregnancy stick, so pinkly confident that it was sharing good news. She had killed a man, gone to prison, endured public shame, reinvented herself, but she couldn't bear the idea of an abortion. At the time, she told herself it was because of being raised Catholic, with her parents dead. There were those who said Polly's conviction put the final nail in her mother's coffin. She should have been free of the church. She was already down for one mortal sin. Why not another? Because, in the back of her head, she couldn't help being curious. What would it be like this time? How hard could it be? Compared to what she had already done and endured? She felt guilty even thinking such thoughts, disloyal to Joy. But the truth was, she wanted the experience of being mother to a normal kid, even if the father was Greg. And Janny was a good kid. Although Polly loved Joy a little bit more. Mothers aren't supposed to say that, feel that. But Polly can't help acknowledging the difference. Janny's a sweetheart, a natural-born winner. She'd be fine. Joy needed her. When she answers Kath, it's with the heat generated by these memories. The losses she has known. The father who dried up like a corn husk, the mother who followed him too quickly, her heart doubly broken, the two daughters, neither one with Polly now because she has done what is best for them. No, I don't play it that way. But maybe you should. It's probably the only way you'll ever get a man to stay, getting knocked up. Good luck with that. Adam says you're a rotten lay. The dew is heavy. Polly's feet are drenched by the time she knocks at the door to room 3. The rain that has been threatening all night starts to fall in sheets, and there are thunderclaps full and close, almost loud enough to drown out the sirens in the distance. It's the last day of August, actually the first day of September, and the first true cold front of the season lies behind this storm. Almost every Labor Day weekend, it seems, the first true cold front arrives. "Rabbit, rabbit," she says to the night air. But maybe it only counts after you go to sleep and wake up. Adam opens his door, sleepy, confused. He's really handsome. She considered his looks too bland the first time she saw him, but now she thinks he's the best-looking man she's ever known. What time is it? "I missed you. But I told Casper today. He doesn't care. Everyone knows about us now, everyone who matters." Turns out he knew all along. "Guess we're not the super sleuths we thought we are." "I think you mean stealthy," he says, "not sleuths." He looks uneasy. "Sleuth, stealth. Let me in, college boy, I'm soaked." She's on top of him when the second wave of sirens start. "Whatever's burning, they must have had to send for another crew," he says, his hands pressing hard into her shoulder blades. "From Millsboro, or wherever. I wonder how anything can burn in this rain." "Who cares?" she says, moving faster. "We're safe." She stays all night into the morning. He's the one who suggests they go out to breakfast at the diner on Main. She contemplates last night's dress, still damp from the downpour. "I can't go out in that." "We'll swing by your place." She and Adam stroll hand in hand toward the center of town. Public at last. Rooted at last. A couple. No more shadows. No more hiding. The morning feels as if the world is new, bright and crisp, and ready for back to school. But an acrid smoke lingers in the breeze, making her nostrils flare with memories of Dittmar's. He used to come home smelling like this, a combination of smoke and chemicals, sometimes even a whiff of death, although he always swore the sweetish, scorched smell was from insulation, not people. and there was no question that Dittmars knew what people smelled like when they burned. Yet, for all her knowledge, Polly is not prepared to turn the corner and see rubble where her apartment once stood. Everything is gone. Smoke is rising from the debris. The volunteer firefighters still bustle about, their long night still not over. It's shameful, but she starts to weep for her small array of possessions, the first thing she's been allowed to choose for herself, her bed, her quilt, her table, her blue glasses, the silk bathrobe, the sundresses from the Purple Heart, tiny things, material things, objects that can be replaced, but they could have been the building blocks of this new life. Then, she sees the gurney, covered by a sheet. It looks flat, but Polly's not fooled. She was an arson investigator's wife. She knows what an explosion can do to a body, how it collapses the internal organs. There's something, someone, under that sheet. Everyone stares at Polly as if she's a ghost. In a sense, she is. Back from the dead, just that quick. Of course, everyone would have assumed it was her, the tenant, in the wreckage. Who else could it be? But as she looks around, she realizes that most of the spectators are horrified in a bland, rubbernecking way. Belleville is a small town, yet few here know her. She spots her landlord, talking to one of the firefighters. He, at least, looks upset in a specific, visible way, but then he's just lost his significant property. Maybe if Max and Ernest strolled by, they would care that Polly is alive. As it is, only Adam knows this is her former home, and he didn't have to worry for a moment that she had been harmed because he's holding her hand, sure of her. He knows it's not her on the gurney. She wonders when he'll realize it has to be Kath. Part 2. Fire. Chapter 22. Adam stands at the grill making the usual lunchtime items. He has his own method of frying burgers. He takes a ball of meat, larger than a golf ball but smaller than a tennis ball, then smashes it with great force, using two spatulas, one on top of the other. After flipping, he places a thin slice of American cheese on each patty. There is simply no better cheese for burgers, no matter one's culinary aspirations. He uses two patties per burger, otherwise the customer will feel he's being shortchanged. Almost everyone values quantity over quality. The patties cook very fast when they are this thin, and he ruins two in a row, mesmerized by the way the flames lunge greedily for the drops of fat. Kath probably did not die by fire. Almost no one ever does. If smoke inhalation didn't get her, then it was probably the explosion itself. A horrible way to die, but quite fast. He hopes it was fast. An official ruling is expected soon. Polly told investigators that morning she had no idea why Kath was in her apartment. The door was unlocked, a custom of small-town living she had come to appreciate. Besides, it couldn't be locked, since Adam kicked it in early Wednesday, although Polly didn't mention that part to the investigators. She did tell them that she and Kath had a habit of stopping by each other's places after work. "You said that?" Adam asked. "That it was a habit." "I had been by her place last week. She came to see me two nights ago and apparently returned. That's enough for a habit, right?" "You make it sound like you were friends. Just being factual." "Lots of people saw me sitting with her at the trailer park last week, having a drink after work. Sure, she probably came by to make trouble for me, but I can't know that. I did tell them that she was trying to blackmail me, and I told them that she couldn't because I had already let you and Mr. C know what she had on me." The stove was old, faulty, finicky. You had to turn the handles just so. Adam knew that. Kath couldn't go more than 30 minutes without a smoke. Everybody knew that. She had probably used the burner to light a cigarette, then failed to turn it all the way off, lit another, and... It could have been my fault, Polly said. I could have been the one who didn't turn it all the way off. And you know how I keep that scarf on my bedside lamp? What if it slipped? Fell against the bulb? I had closed the windows because I knew rain was coming, and if there was already gas and a little fire started... I kept meaning to tell the landlord about that stove, but the rent was cheap and I didn't cook much. Not in this summer heat. Her story makes sense, Adam thinks, tossing the overdone burgers. Some chefs would try to serve them, wait to see if the customers complained, but he would never do that. He pounds another globe of beef into submission. Story. Why does he think of it as a story? There was so much confusion at the scene. The first responders were the local volunteers, unused to dealing with a blaze of this magnitude, hampered by the heavy rains, which helped keep the flames from spreading to the other buildings on Main, but made a sodden mess of the wreckage. They thought they were doing the right thing, moving Kath's body when they found it in the early morning hours, but they compromised the investigation into her death. They also began to question Polly on the spot, as she stood there holding Adam's hand. Where were you? Who is this? She told them she had gone to Adam's place about midnight, that she had no idea who was in her apartment, but she recognized Kath's car, parked right there on Main. Later they found Kath's keyring, a heavy knob of turquoise, in the wreckage. When Adam was asked during a more formal interview what time Polly came by his room, he agreed it was about midnight. But the fact is, he doesn't know. He was asleep. He knows what she said to them. He assumes it's true. He's pretty sure it's true. It has been 5 days since the fire. Kath's sister came to town Sunday, husband in tow, screaming and crying and hurling accusations. They told the Delaware State Police investigators that Kath had all sorts of dirt on Polly, that the whole thing had to be a setup. But Polly had already owned her past, said she had told Mr. C and Adam what was what, and that Kath was angry because she had no real leverage. Polly begged police not to let word get out. But it was a small town, and the gossip skipped and whirled from mouth to mouth, too delicious not to be shared. Yet when the gossip settled, all anyone really knew was that Polly had a sad, brutal past. Yes, she had killed her husband. Yes, there was skepticism about her exoneration, but what was done was done. No one could see how Polly, in bed with Adam, could be responsible for an explosion almost a mile away. Maybe Kath had gone there to confront Polly, then decided to lie in wait for her. Maybe, Polly told the state investigators. I should tell you, she had other reasons to be mad at me. She had a thing for Adam. We tried to keep our relationship quiet, out of respect for her feelings, but that was the real source of her anger, the reason she wanted to run me out of town. Adam chose me over her. There is no daily newspaper in Belleville. Kath's death received a scant mention in the Wilmington paper and was the third story in the second break on the so-called Delmarva stations out of Salisbury. Belleville woman dead in explosion. That's that. Nothing's going to happen. Adam doesn't have to say or do anything more. I guess you could call it karma, Polly said at one point. She tried to hurt me and she ended up hurt. Karma. That's a name for it. Coincidence, too. Accident. A check comes in, he flips it around. Adam and Eve, whiskey down. Very funny, he says. They don't have to plan their rendezvous anymore. It's the real thing, Polly calls over her shoulder. Do we have any rye bread? Polly has to cover all the shifts now. Business is still brisk this first week of September. When she's not working, she sits on his bed in room 3, looking at the classifieds. She's circling things, houses for sale, not rent, and in the best part of town where the streets are named for flowers and trees.
You really want to put down roots here?
I thought that's what we agreed to.
Did they?
He feels his restlessness kicking in. The fall is when he usually travels. It wasn't that long ago that he thought he might go to New Zealand this autumn, catch its spring, or somewhere on the other side of the equator. Flip the seasons, flip your life. Flip this burger, Adam, don't burn another one. Now he can't imagine going anywhere without her. Still, he has an itchy foot, and she's sitting on the bed circling real estate ads.
How are you going to afford to buy a house? He asked her last night. You don't get the insurance on the building.
It's supposed to be a joke, but it becomes a question, a plea for assurance. Please tell me that you don't have insurance on the apartment, on your belongings, on Kath. If what Irving said was true, but maybe nothing Irving said was true.
I'm going to come into some money soon, she says.
From what?
It's just a feeling I have. Don't you ever have those? Like a sixth sense about something that's going to happen? It's in my palm.
Her landlord is paying for her to stay at the motel, but Adam never visits her room. She comes to him now.
How he misses that apartment.
Maybe more than she does, he thinks. Did she know all along that it wasn't going to be her home? All summer she had said she had to be moving on, but she loved those things, he knows it. She also loves her freedom. She would not have risked that cavalierly. About midnight, she taps on his door. Their lovemaking has become more savage as of late, which surprises him. When a secret romance goes public, things usually get tamer. Even as she circles ads for homes, plots domestic life, she retains this innate wildness in bed. What is their future? He would be crazy to marry her, have children with her. He will be crazy without her. Finished, he stares at the ceiling, wills himself not to speak, waits for her to fall asleep. Then, very nonchalantly, was it midnight when you came by? Tonight? Then. Oh, I think so. Thereabouts. You know I don't have a watch anymore. And it was humid before the rain started, so I was walking pretty slowly. Thunderclap. The rain coming down in sheets. He feels as if he heard the thunder first, then saw the lightning, but that's not how it works. Could it have been the explosion that he heard? All he has to do is call the weather service, find out what time the storm started, and he'll know what time she was on his doorstep. What does it matter? As she says, she no longer has a watch. In that conflagration, it melted as surely as that watch in Salvador Dali's famous painting. Chapter 23. Polly loves Thursdays, the day that the area weekly paper is published. She gets up at 6 and walks to the Royal Farms to buy a copy, then curls up on one of the benches near the window that gets strong morning light. She could take the paper back to her room, but she thinks of the Royal Farms as her office, a place to tend to business until she has her own place. Once a week, she buys cards, sends them to Janny and Joy, obviously no longer afraid for Greg to know where she is. She reads the real estate ads as if they were love poems. Cozy cottage with fruit trees, 3 beds, 2 baths, your dream house awaits. 2 beds, 1 bath, needs TLC. She's not naive. She can translate the optimistic real estate speak. Cramped shack with bug-infested trees. A waking nightmare yearns to scare you. House reviled for good reason. But she prefers a fixer-upper.
She wants her next house to be hers, truly hers, tailored to her particular needs and specifications. Her dream house awaits. When Greg bought the house on Kentucky Avenue, she tried to believe it could be her dream house. It had small touches of what felt like grandeur to her. A built-in break front, a heavy swinging door between dining room and kitchen, a glass transom over the front door, the house number etched in gold. But it was just an ordinary 1940s house. The neighborhood, even in its glory days, had never been better than middle class. People had expected more once upon a time. You didn't have to be rich to have a break front. Now, everywhere you look, it's about size. Polly doesn't want a big house, no more than 3 bedrooms, preferably a rancher. In the decor magazines, she has begun to study photos of places that were considered modern 40 years ago. She's fond of uncluttered rooms, as few objects as possible, smooth wood floors, bedrooms with nothing but beds, nightstands, a single dresser. She will never buy another iron bed or metal top table. She wouldn't mind doing the whole house in IKEA furniture. Although she would have to rent a big U-Haul to get it all over here from Baltimore. She's not in a hurry to realize this dream. Good thing, because she's no longer sure how quickly the divorce will come through now that she's decided not to go to Reno. But how much longer could it take? With things so cut and dried between Greg and her. She'll give him everything he wants, which she assumes is everything. So, 6 months? Maybe a year? A year's a long time, but she's endured longer stretches of waiting, in and out of prison. Still, it's worrisome. She had planned to be free of Greg no later than November. Maybe she and Adam should both leave Belleville and head to Nevada. No one's forcing them to stay here. Kath Whitmire's death has been ruled an accident. They found enough of her skull to rule the cause of death blunt force trauma, consistent with a gas explosion. The case is closed. Only, it's not. Kath's sister and brother-in-law keep agitating. They know people. What with him working for the state police and her a court stenographer. They have complained that the investigation was botched, that Polly should have been treated as a suspect, not a lucky witness who escaped death by paying an impromptu booty call. They pointed out that the volunteer fire department made myriad mistakes at the scene. That was Jim's quote in the Wilmington News Journal. Myriad mistakes at the scene. If Polly leaves town now, with or without Adam, everyone will think she's guilty. That shouldn't bother her. But it does. Polly wonders if Kath's people have come to regret making a stink. Because while the News Journal has dutifully reported Polly's life story, apartment's tenant was a Baltimore woman who had killed her husband after years of alleged abuse, then been granted a controversial pardon. It also dug up Kath's past, which is almost as interesting. As a 17-year-old high school senior, she had jumped another girl who was taunting her. The two had been on the elevated ramp at an old driving range, a place where high school students went to smoke dope and drink beer. The railing gave way, and the other girl had fallen, breaking her neck. Kath went to a juvenile facility. The other girl was in a wheelchair for life. So, yes, there was a record of rage and anger, consistent with lying in wait for a woman she was trying to blackmail. If Polly had known before about Kath's temper... No, she thinks it's better she didn't know. But the brother-in-law can't let go. When Polly arrives for work on this particular Thursday, he's sitting in the Hi-Ho parking lot in his state trooper car. His tanned, brawny forearm on the window ledge makes Polly think of a thick snake basking in the middle of the road, one you'd almost go out of your way to slice with your tires. She wonders if it's allowed, using his official car on this not-quite-official business. "I want to talk to you," he says, without preamble. She doesn't have to cooperate with him, of course. She could get a restraining order, complain to his bosses. She has been cleared. It's unseemly, the way he uses his job to badger her.
But Polly knows a thing or two about cops. She knows how they close ranks, even behind the worst of the worst. Her husband was a dirty cop, and his colleagues had to have suspected as much. There was a pattern, if anyone cared to find it. Beyond his own criminal activities, he was just a lousy guy. He hit her, threatened horrible things. His co-workers had to have known that was true as well. But he was one of theirs, and she had killed him, and that wasn't allowed. Killing was a perk that cops kept for themselves. Themselves, and maybe little old ladies shooting blindly toward an intruder in the middle of the night. "What do you want to talk about?" She stops, but doesn't get in the car, which is clearly his intent. She doesn't want to be in a confined space with him. Then again, she's not going to let him follow her inside, where Adam is already at work prepping for lunch. "What really happened that night?" "Only she knows for sure. I wasn't there."
"Why wasn't your door locked?"
"I never lock the door. No one locks their doors here. It's Belleville."
"We could bring a lawsuit against you, you know."
That gets her attention. "For what?"
"Liability. You knew that stove wasn't safe."
"That's on the landlord. He says you didn't report it." "Yeah, well, I'm not sure that trespassers have any right to be assured that the appliances they use are in perfect condition." She goes inside the hi-ho. Not in the least bit of a hurry. Or a fluster. Still, he has needled her. And she mulls what he has said as she moves on autopilot through the steps of readying for the lunch service. Could Kath's family really sue her? Can she be held accountable? She has heard about cases where people claim civil damages, even when criminal liability is unproven. She should ask a lawyer. But no one knows better than she does that you can't even say, "How are you?" to a lawyer without starting the clock. There's a famous old saying, "He who steals my purse steals trash. He who steals my good name," etc., etc. People can do whatever they want to her name. But Polly likes her purse, thank you very much.
"What did he want?"
Adam asks. So he, too, saw the car, saw Kath's brother-in-law. He's just being a jerk. Probably to appease that crazy wife of his. Tried to scare me by saying they could sue because I knew that old stove was dangerous. Can someone really sue me for that?
"People can sue for anything," Adam says.
She had expected a more comforting reply from him. She stews about Jim's threat the rest of the day, is snappish with Max and Ernest when they come in. Not that they notice or care. No matter how she treats them, each man leaves a lone dollar at the end. Usually a soft, limp one that looks as if it's been dug out of a back pocket. Never more, never less. As if her actions don't matter. Polly is so tired of men deciding how much money she deserves. Ditmars, who kept her on a strict allowance. Greg, ditto. Even her landlord, who seemed like such a sweetheart, stated flatly how long he was willing to stake her to a motel room while she tried to find a new place. Maybe she should sue him. No, better to let that go if she's going to stay in Belleville. The town has been remarkably forgiving of the newcomer whose faulty stove killed one of their own. This is the time to live and let live. For the landlord, if not for poor Kath. If she and Adam stay together, will he police her money? Will she be asked to show her receipts, to account for every cent? "Show me a man's wallet and I'll show you his soul," she thinks, as she pockets Max and Ernest's sad little dollars. Was that a famous saying? It should be. Chapter 24. Irving Lowenstein has no voicemail. If someone wants to leave a message for him, Susie takes it down, writes it on one of those pink while you were out slips. This morning there are three, all from the same number, which he recognizes immediately. A tenant. That means money going out instead of in. Irving owns only a few properties now, mainly on the northwest side. He once had more than 40, 36 apartments and 10 houses, some commercial in the mix. But it was too much work, and all he ever got for his trouble was labels, slumlord. As if he were the one who made the places slums. They started out nice, his units. Now, he's down to one commercial property and three residential ones. He'd like to get rid of those. But he has a soft spot for the tenants, elderly women, good people, if prone to neediness. Today, it's Mrs. McAllister, on Oakley Road, says the hot water heater is acting up. It's a pretty new heater, so he's not sure what could be wrong. Turns out the pilot blew out. Something he can fix, although anything with gas makes him a little nervous. He's in and out in less than 15 minutes, and the day is so nice. The first real fallish day of September, even if the calendar says there are 10 more days to autumn. He decides to eat an early lunch in a diner on Garrison Boulevard. But when he comes out at noon, it's hot again. The day's promise is broken. Noon on the dot. He notices on the dashboard clock. High noon. Yes, it's coming on high noon. In more ways than one. They think he's stupid, those two. Why not? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice. But she hasn't fooled him twice. He has been on to her for a very long time. Maybe she's like one of those diseases you get as a kid. Once you've had it, you're immune. He had a little case of the Pauline Dittmar's blues, but once she cheated him, he was over it. There are a lot of women in the world. Only so many dollars. Irving likes having money, although he permits himself few indulgences. The nice things, such as the house, were for his wife. And Bertie's gone. Irving likes having his money in the bank, in brokerage accounts, in retirement funds. His account balances are proof that everyone was wrong about him, his parents, who wouldn't support him past the age of 16, forcing him to drop out of high school. The teachers, who gave him C's and D's, when he knew he was the sharpest in the class. The insurance agents with whom he works, who put so much stock into appearances, with their expensive cars and suits and haircuts. I don't waste money on luxuries, Irving tells new clients when they visit his office. You see a fancy office? You're looking at waste. I don't have a big nut, so I have no incentive into getting you to bite off more than you can chew. And I'm a broker. I find the best policy for you. I work for you. 90% of the time, every word was true. 95% of his customers paid their premiums, and the policies were there when they needed them. People in insurance sell something that everyone resents paying for until they need it, and then it's never as good as they think it should be. Doesn't make for popularity. Yet he's the one who's there for them, time and time again. Irving has helped families bury people, send children to college, survive natural disasters. He has consoled survivors and widows. Helped to create a few widows, too, but that wasn't his fault. Not really. It started in the early 1980s, when he still had properties in the county. He had a tenant in Dundalk, just over the city line. She was okay, but her kids were trouble. Moved in, basically turned the house into a shooting gallery. Place was trashed. But she paid the rent. Somehow, every month, the rent was paid. He couldn't evict them without cause, and he couldn't prove they were selling drugs out of the house. Maybe he should have let it go. They were paying on time. But once they vacated, it was going to cost him a year's rent to get the place back into shape. They let metal men scavenge the appliances, then claimed they had been burglarized. Their hot water heater was stolen, or so they said. He needed them gone. He started to spy on them, thinking he would see something that would allow him to kick them out. But tenants have too many rights in Maryland, and he never caught them in an open act of thievery. One night, he was wandering down the alley, smoking a cigar, trying not to look too conspicuous. It was a mixed neighborhood, still more white than black, yet Irving felt he stood out here, and it occurred to him that people couldn't live in a house with a little fire damage. He tossed his cigar in the overflowing trash container behind the house. Such pigs they were. And it was a slow-starting fire. The smoke was only beginning to rise in the sky as he pulled away in his Buick. They would have had plenty of time to get out if their senses hadn't been dulled by drugs, or if the smoke alarms had worked. Three people died. That's when Ditmars came into Irving's life. Later, too late, Irving would come to understand that the guy was always dirty. Ditmars was born dirty, couldn't play it straight even when straight was the better play. He needed to be getting